Welcome to the ProWrestling.net All Access Podcast. I'm Jason Powell here with an interview with Jason Williams, the son of the late pro wrestling manager, the late great Gary Hart. And we are going to be talking about, I think for many of you, the best pro wrestling book you have yet to read. And I'm not just laying it on thick because Jason's here. I've been praising this book on Twitter and in the .NET members forum and whatnot for a while. It's a book that Court Bauer, former WWE creative team member, suggested I read, and it took me long enough to get around to it. And I got the thing in the mail, finally. You know, the delivery was nice and prompt, but it was my fault for just taking forever to order this thing. And Jason, I get the book, and I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be your typical pro wrestling 250, 300 pages maybe. This thing is like 400 and some pages, and it's like smaller print. This thing is, I mean, it's just packed with all sorts of info. So poor Jason, I've been just dragging this out forever. It took me a while to get through the book, but a phenomenal read. So why don't you tell us about how this book came together, and you know, just I know that your dad wrote this book with he had someone who actually wrote it with him, but you know, what was your dad's involvement, and I mean, it had to be substantial.
Well, about I guess about 7 or 8 years ago, Dad started doing fan conventions, because Dad pretty much dropped out of sight from the wrestling business pretty much after he left WCW. And then he had a little bit of an involvement when my little brother was starting wrestling. But he didn't really – he was one of the last guys to really break the kayfabe thing.
Yeah.
And he pretty much kept going with that until about 2003, 2004. And then the late, great Sir Oliver Humperdinck started doing a few fan conventions and sort of, you know, had sort of like getting Punxsutawney Phil to come out of the stump on Groundhog's Day, you know. He said,
right.
why don't you come out and do a few of these things with me? So Dad did a couple of them, and he really started to like them. And people at all the conventions kept asking him, why don't you do a book? And then another good friend of his, Steve Harms, was with him at a few of these conventions, and Steve said to him, Gary, why don't you actually do a book? And Dad goes, well, who would care? But then a few more people kept asking. And then Philip Variely, who actually wrote the book, got in contact with a friend of mine, Steve Harms. And Phil had gotten in contact with Steve. And Steve had called Dad and said, there's a guy that would really like to do your book. He did J.J. Dillon's book, and he did Lou Albano's book. He would like to talk with you. And Dad goes, give him my number, see what happens. And Dad and Philip talked and clicked instantly, and it just took off from there.
Well, before we get going any
further. That was longer than one of my dad's promos, by the way, which is pretty hard to do.
Before we get going, I want to plug this right off the bat. If you're interested in the book, and it's called Playboy Gary Hart, My Life in Wrestling with a Little Help from My Friends. It's available at playboygaryhart.net. Listeners should be familiar with the .NET thing. So playboygaryhart.net. Don't be intimidated by the price, because I will admit, when I first saw that it was $30 plus shipping and handling, I'm like, oh, boy. But then when you get the book and you see just, you know, like I say, how many pages there are, the print size, and it's not like it's so small you strain to read it. It's just, you know, it really, they pack a lot into those 400 and some pages. I can't recommend the book enough. I really enjoyed this. I put it on par with books such as Bret Hart's, another guy who wrote a really long, detailed book, Chris Jericho's book, Mick Foley's book. It's not going to, you know, he doesn't just crack one joke after another like Chris Jericho and Mick Foley did, but there's certainly a real sense of humor in the book, too. It's not just real straightforward without much humor like Bret. And so I just can't say enough about it. And so it's a pleasure to have you here to discuss this. And if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about your dad's career, because I think, you know, it was a learning experience for me. It's a real history lesson, too, because your dad started in the business so many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us, you know, I knew going into the book that he worked as a booker behind the scenes in world class, but it wasn't just there. I mean, he was more than just an on-air pro wrestling manager character. He wrestled, he booked. So if you don't mind, just kind of give us an overview of your dad's career.
Well, pretty much he started in like 1960, and he got turned on to wrestling, actually, at an early age. Like, he was like 9 or 10, he used to go see his uncle in Southern Illinois, who would watch wrestling from the Chase, and you would see, like, Bobby Manigault, Buddy Rogers, Sonny Myers, Rip Hawk, guys like that. And actually, he would go to the YMCA when he was a kid, and he would see Rip Hawk, and he would throw stuff at him. And then he got involved in wrestling in Chicago at the Marigold, and he was trained by Billy Gills and Johnny Case. And as far as a wrestler, he was all right, but his real first break came when he got with Angelo Poffo, and he became Angelo's manager slash tag team partner and learned a lot from him. And then he went on to work with George Steele, the student, in Detroit. And he basically had a real feel for sort of like how great coaches aren't always the greatest players. Like Jimmy Johnson wasn't the greatest player ever, but he was an excellent coach. And there's some guys who are great football, who are great players, that aren't the best coaches. But his main force and his main thing that he liked to do was to see a young piece of talent and try to bring it along. And a lot of, and all that whole vibe that he put off as far as like the manager, because he felt that I'm going to be a manager, I'm going to be a manager. He didn't want to be like what we would used to call just like a leg puller who would just come down to the ring and just, you know, yell at the fans and everything like that. Because Dad never, if you ever really noticed, he never would yell at the fans. He would, the only way he would get them mad is because the best way to get somebody mad is to basically tell them the truth, you know?
Right.
So just tell the truth about the guys that they like, and that'll really get some anger from them. But as far as his being like a character, that was just really a more aggressive side of him, because he was a street kid, and you know, he was that was the way he was. So that's why the whole jive talking and the nice expensive suits and all that really wasn't a character. That was really him. It was just a amped up version of him, because I swear to God, when I see him do interviews and when I see him get hot on TV, I've witnessed that myself when I would bring home a bad report card. You know, he cut some of his best promos on me that nobody saw.
Oh, I can only imagine. And
oh yeah,
you mentioned the street smart part of it, and that I never knew if that was just part of the character that he played. And I mean, because we've all seen wrestlers that resemble, you know, are nothing like their characters at times. But with him, you know, that was one of the it really hooked me from the beginning. Was he was talking about how he worked unknowingly at first, but he ended up doing some work with a Chicago mob group. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All I know is that it had something to do with cigarette machines or pool tables or something, and that's about. He didn't really talk that much about that.
Yeah, and he didn't. It wasn't like it was a badge of honor for him. I mean, he didn't shy away from it in the book at all. He was open about what he did and what he witnessed, but you could tell that he was looking forward to getting away from it too. But it was just one. I mean, what a fascinating life to start out as this, you know, teenage kid getting into wrestling and then also having this mob connection. But he also, I mean, he spent a lot of time, and I never knew this, in Australia booking for. Jim Barnett, who he speaks extremely high of in the book, legendary promoter. And did you were, this was before your time, so did you ever make any trips to Australia? I know he ended up going back a couple times.
I never got to go to Australia, but from everything that he said and everything I could get from it, that was probably his favorite time of his career. Because number one, you're in Australia. Number two, you're on the beach. And number three, he was with, that was at the time that he was really, really starting to become and do what it was that he wanted to do, because he was with my Uncle Donald the Spoiler, he was with my Uncle Marky Mark Lewin, and he was with all of his friends, you know, and they were doing fabulous business. And that was probably his favorite time of his career at that point in time, because not only what he was doing, but who he was doing it with. And he was with Jim Barnett, who, in all honesty, is, I would have to say, is the father of was the smartest guy in the history of the wrestling business. It was the most important guy in the history of wrestling. And a lot of people, unless like the last 10-15 years, is actually the last actually 5 or 6 people really have become familiar with who Jim was. But people think Vince McMahon is the greatest promoter ever. Vince McMahon was also another one who had wise learning at the knee of Jim Barnett. All of them, anybody who was ever influential in the business, Mark Lewin, my father, Ole Anderson, Vince McMahon, Bill Watts, Fritz Von Erich, they were all students of Jim Barnett.
And one of the areas where I gained so much respect for your dad was, here's this street smart kid done a little bit of work with the mob from Chicago.
Yeah, like Shawn Michaels said, it's basically a more amped up version of who you already are.
Well, you know, but when you think, especially from that era when he grew up in, here's mm-hmm. a street smart kid from Chicago, carries a blade around with him for protection.
Oh, really? I never knew that.
Well, we'll definitely get to the blade, but the thing that I really liked is that he really had a code that he lived by. He especially, you know, Jim Barnett, openly homosexual.
And that's fine.
Yeah, and you know, your dad, being the street smart kid from Chicago, not only didn't have any issues with it, mm-hmm. Tell us about how he was. I believe it was Dory Funk Sr. booked him as the gay Gary Hart character.
Oh yeah,
and he didn't care for it at all.
Well, what he said is Mr. Funk said, we're going to call you gay Gary Hart, because he already had the blonde hair from his Hurricane Hart days, because we know how the hurricanes tend to hit Chicago. And so that's from Orlando, Florida, and he had never been outside of Chicago yet, and he hadn't even been to Florida yet. And Mr. Funk said, I want to call you gay Gary Hart. And Dad goes, you can call me that, but I'm not going to go out there. I'm not going to do anything that's going to demean homosexuals. And this is like 1965, 66, you know, where any type of prejudice, be it, you know, against sexual preference or against or color of your skin or creed or ethnicity, was really, really, if you were white, you know, it was just one of those things. But he just said, no, I'm not gonna do anything that's gonna degrade homosexuals or insult them. He goes, but you can call me that, but you know, I'm not gonna act like that. So what he would normally do, he would take a rose and hand it to an overweight black woman who'd be in the front row.
Wow, and you know, speaking of black, he was also a guy that, in the South, when you know, during really tough times as far as racial relations went, he was one of the few guys that had no problem, and in fact wanted to work with some of the African American wrestlers.
Because I think it's because he came from Chicago.
Yeah,
and it was, and he didn't really understand it. You know, to be completely honest with you, he didn't really understand the whole racism thing. And he had told me, and the fondest memory, and you know, because you have so many matches over so many years, you don't really remember all of them. And occasionally when he would be working independence with my little brother, who was just starting to wrestle, there'd be guys who'd be amazed to see Gary Hart in an independent dressing room. So one time, this one guy came up to him and he said, what's the fondest, anything that sticks out in your career, Gary? And Dad goes, talking about, he was wrestling, I believe it was Tiger Conway.
Yeah.
At the old Fort Worth Stockyards, an arena in Fort Worth, Texas. This is in the mid to late, this was like, had been 1966, 67. Most guys wouldn't wrestle a black wrestler. And Dad said, I'll wrestle him. And so Dad wrestled him straight through, and I'm sure did a job, because he always did, even when he was on top. And there was a section of the Cowtown Coliseum in Fort Worth where only the black people were allowed to sit, because it was very segregated.
Wow.
And his dad had went to the ring. He had wrestled Tiger Conway, and he had lost the match, and he came back up the aisle. And as he's coming back up the aisle, everyone in the segregated black section stood up and gave him a standing ovation.
Man.
And he just sort of stood there and went, hmm. And that is, if you ask him one moment that stuck out in his career, you know, because you always, I mean, there's hundreds of matches. I mean, yeah, I'm sure he remembers the 80 gazillion times that Fritz put the claw on him and Uncle Donald. but he said that one really, really stood out, because it wasn't so much a wrestling thing. It was like a, wow. Because, I mean, he didn't see any of that, and I was pretty much the same way. I never understood prejudice or racism, you know.
Well,
I never really got into that. I mean, look at my dating track record. That'll tell you.
Okay. And, you know, I mean, that really says a lot about, especially for that time, when kayfabe really existed, that African-American group of fans would stand up and applaud him. It was like, you know, they knew that somehow, even though they may have actually thought this was real, who knows, but they knew enough that this means something, that, you know, he really is going out there and is doing the right thing and working with Tiger.
And to be completely honest with you, there's a guy named John Wiley Price, who's a prominent political figure here, and I know he's in some trouble now, but there was also another gentleman named Al Lipscomb. And they were county commissioners here in Dallas, which is a pretty sizable black community here in Dallas. And in 1981, 82, when Dad was with Armand Hussein, they actually came down to the arena, to the sportatorium, and wanted to meet Dad and thank him for the way he always helped champion and helped the black wrestler prosper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Fritz Von Erich, and
yes.
I mean, I had no idea what a rocky relationship they really had behind the scenes. I mean, there
mm-hmm.
was certainly respect there.
They were like Mick and Keith, right?
Oh, you know, maybe even worse, because, you know, while I think this is just what I took from the book, is that while Fritz knew that your dad was a big part of the success, apparently he also thought he was replaceable, which is bizarre. I mean, you go through the book, and obviously it's written from your dad's perspective, and
mm-hmm.
Others may find fault with it. I don't know. But he was able to really get Fritz's promotion, really, I mean, running strong. And
mm-hmm.
then about the time they really started making great money, Fritz decided to start shorting your father and just deemed him replaceable. And, you know, he had to know that your dad wasn't going to take it, just because, you know, you read a few chapters of the book and you quickly figure out that this is one guy who's not just going to sit back and take it if somebody gives him a low payoff. He's going to bail. And yet, you know, Fritz let him go. And that was just the on-again, off-again relationship that they had. I thought that dynamic was fascinating.
Here's the thing with that. There are two things, and I always try to clear this up. There's this theory that Texas didn't really get hot until right before the Freebird Von Erich thing started, and that was a big part of what happened here. But we did sell out business here way before that. Kabuki did sell out business here before that. My Uncle Mark Lewin and Uncle Donald the Spoiler and Brody and all those guys in Harley Race, they did big business here before. But what had happened in 82, that was just reigniting it again. Because a lot of time, because, I mean, in all honesty, after 18 months, you're tired of looking at somebody.
Sure.
You know? And Dad's whole thing with the Freebirds and the Von Erichs is he was going to bring them in, and him and Kabuki were going to go do some more work for Jim Barnett and Ole Anderson and get them off of TV here a little bit here. But that's the one thing. Texas was always Texas started thriving here in 67 as soon as my dad put the mask on the Spoiler. That's when it really started. Did it go through some up and down periods? Yes, because guys got old, like Bull Curry and all of that. And Fritz, and it was time to change things, to reload. And things ran, and when the boys started, when the Von Erich brothers started, business got hot. Then it just got, because, I mean, if Texas didn't draw before the Freebirds, why was it sold out here in August of 82 in the reunion when Kerry wrestled Ricky in the now infamous best 2 out of 3 fall match? So that's just one. I know I got on a soapbox there, but Texas drew before the Freebird. And I love Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts, and they did exactly what they were supposed to do. They reignited the place. But Texas had done business, big business before. But as far as Fritz Von Erich goes, and Dad and I talked a lot about Fritz towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
You know, I had a lot of conversations with Dad. Fritz was never a hoverer. You know, he wasn't someone who's
not a micromanager.
No, not at all. Because what he would do is he would call him Dad and say, "Scooter, we're going to go ahead and have a meeting on the on Monday, but I'm out doing some stuff with my cows or looking at some land. So here's where I want you to meet me." And Dad would always have to have Bronco Lubitsch, the referee, driving there, because he'd be like out in a trailer. The directions would be like, "Okay, go 30 miles down the highway, take a left. Then once you pass this big rock, hang another left. Then there's going to be this pond." So he would have to have Bronco drive him out there. But Fritz was not a micromanager, and he was not a hoverer. He knew that Dad knew what he was doing, you know, so he didn't have to worry about whatever Dad was doing. He knew that he was in capable hands, and he knew Dad was a stand-up guy. That's why he trusted him, and he was never let go. Fritz never fired my dad. My dad always walked away. He was never, because Fritz would never fire my dad, because he knew, Fritz knew above all else, because of their, I mean, and they didn't hate each other. They loved each other in a certain way. I know they had to have.
Sure.
Because I remember when Fritz passed away, I said, you know, that old man loved you, and Dad goes, and I loved him. You know, I mean, were they buddy-buddy? No. But it was sort of like, Dad was kind of like his rebellious little brother, and Fritz was always like, why don't you just do, if you just do what I tell you, it'd be a lot easier, you know, in that respect, you know?
Well, it was always interesting, too, in the book that, you know, when your dad, because your dad was very outspoken, and that rubbed type A personality Fritz the wrong way, but
and that's probably why Fritz, and that's why Fritz trusted him so much, because he, Fritz knew, above all else, if all else failed, I got Gary. And he's got to be, because Fritz actually told him one time, you're the one, you know, Scooter, you're the only one who tells me the truth and doesn't tell me just what I want to hear. And Dad goes, well, you wouldn't trust me if I didn't, would you? You know, and that was their relationship.
But, I mean, what was it? Do you think it was just greed? I mean, that's how it came across in the book, that Fritz would, you know, the business would start to go up and Fritz would get greedy and give your dad that low payoff, which he had to know was going to send your dad over the edge and he's going to walk.
I, to be honest with you, maybe when I see Fritz one day again in the next life, I'll ask him. But I'm not exactly, you know, I don't know. I mean, because what happened is about a less than a year later, he had asked Dad to come back.
Right.
You know, but to be honest with you, I have no idea. What happened between Dad and Fritz, and I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall the day that Dad got that payoff and went upstairs, but. Dad never really, he never said anything bad about Fritz. I don't think there was any, I mean, they made too much money together not to like each other, but to be honest with you, I don't know what that was all about. I mean, because it was built strong enough to where anybody could have run it for a while, and obviously did, but I don't know exactly what all that was about.
Yeah,
to be completely honest with you, I can't under. I mean, and it's damn near 30 years later. I'm not too sure what led. I mean, and to be honest with you, Dad was not always. Dad was pretty, you know, when it came to his stuff, you know, he was very, very guarded about it. He didn't like anybody messing with anything that he was involved in. So he was not always. He was, like Dad used to tell me, maybe this can shed some light on the question. Dad used to always tell me, and because he told my brother when my brother was wanting to start in the business, and he would be around people that had been around my dad. My dad told me, he goes, son, if you ask someone about your father who was in the business with me, they will tell you. And I knew, and I was always involved in the business. I always asked questions about it, and I was always interested. Dad said, you'll ask a lot of guys about your father. They'll say, he was difficult, but he always drew. So maybe the answer is in that statement.
Yeah, and I mean, what a fascinating relationship. I mean, that's something that I think at least fans our age are really going to get into it if they check out the book is the world-class section. And there, I mean, there's, I guess, multiple sections on it. And you mentioned the Freebirds, and I just wanted to clarify this. Your dad is actually responsible for bringing them into the territory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, I mean, one of the, I guess the guy, because with Fritz, I didn't take it like your dad was bad-mouthing him at all. It was just a case of, I'm telling the story. You know, this is my perspective, and this is...
Oh, yeah, and that's why I think his relationship with Fritz was as strong as it was, because, I mean, it's like, if you're, I mean, like, some people, you can, like a lot of people would be, you know, like, there are certain things that only certain people can say to you.
Yeah.
That was their relationship,
sure.
You know?
Well,
yeah, I mean, but I will say this: there wouldn't have, had there not been a Fritz von Erich, there wouldn't have been a Gary Hart. He gave my dad the greatest gift that he could ever have, and that was Kevin, Kerry, and David. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly want to talk about them, but with if there's one guy that comes across like a bit of a villain in the book, it has to be your dad's replacement as the Booker of World Class, Ken Mantell. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, was it just always a negative relationship between the two? Was there just some jealousy on both sides of the fence?
I don't think there was any jealousy as far as Dad went. I think it was jealousy as far as Ken went, because Fritz didn't trust Ken, didn't trust his judgment. And cause Fritz saw within about, I think, less than a year that Ken was just a one-trick pony, because all he knew how to do was book the Von Erichs against the Freebirds. And,
yeah.
Gee, wonder how he saw how to do that. Ken was really in over his head and didn't really trust him. And everything Fritz thought Ken was trying to do, Ken ended up proving Fritz right about 2 or 3 years later. Ken was, when you're in a situation where you're the matchmaker, but the top angles and the top guys are under the tutelage of somebody else. Because think about it. Fritz brought Dad back here in 84 to turn Chris heel, Chris Adams.
Right.
Because he knew that Ken was incapable of it. Then, to reestablish Kerry, Dad went with the head shave and brought in the one-man gang. Then he was going to turn the one-man gang babyface. So it's like, yeah, Chris and Gino and the one-man gang and Mark Lewin, they're all listening to Gary Hart, but Ken, you're still in charge. You know, one of those type of things. It was animosity because Ken didn't really know how to do anything. I mean, he put Sunshine with the Great Kabuki. I mean,
right.
he took, you know, the most evil wrestler ever on the face of God's green earth and had him being controlled by a woman. I mean, my God, Gary Hart, wrestling's answer to Al Capone, would be leery of him. You know, it was just Ken was, if there was jealousy, it was all on Ken's part because Ken was really not, there's matchmakers and there's bookers. Ken was a booker. He would line out names on a page. I mean, my God, if you give me the 1997-98 WCW roster, I could book sellouts, too, with everybody being over.
Well, you brought up that, you know, that was one of the things your dad kept pointing to in the book. And because when it's different. Before reading the book, when I would think matchmaker, I'm thinking, okay, that's a guy who knows what the good matches are going to be and can just put them out there. But your dad had a different way of looking at that and more of the traditional old school way than I did. So that was a learning experience. Tell me what the difference is between a matchmaker and a booker.
A matchmaker is a guy who a booker basically puts names on a page, you know. A matchmaker is somebody, let's say you got a guy that's really, let's take the, I don't want to get sued, so I don't want to say his name. Let's say we take, what's a good example here? Let's say a guy like Bill Goldberg, okay?
Sure.
Let's say when he was just starting out, was very, very raw. Very, very raw, but very, very good. Really had a lot to offer. So what do we have to do? We know how the people perceive this guy. The people see this guy as an animal, as he's somebody who needs to be knocking everybody over. A matchmaker takes a guy like that and says, we got to put him with people that can make him look the way the people see him.
Gotcha. And let me reset this. This is Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net here with Jason Williams, son of the late, great Gary Hart. We're discussing Playboy Gary Hart, My Life in Wrestling, with a little help from my friends. Don't forget, you can order that book right now at PlayboyGaryHart.net. Highly recommended book. You mentioned Kabuki, and that was something that really interested me as well, as your dad. I mean, there's always been characters in wrestling. I mean, especially, you know, in this era, I mean, it really came to fruition with Vince McMahon and the Hulk Hogan era, the cartoonish era. But your dad kind of seemed like he was at the forefront of creating some, at least one for the time, a truly elaborate character in Great Kabuki. And, you know, growing up as a kid watching World Class, I had no idea that your dad was the brains behind that. I mean, this isn't a character that had success in Japan and just came to World Class. This was your dad's vision. Tell us about that.
What Dad did with Kabuki is what Kevin Nash would call a persona makeover extreme.
Yeah.
It's exactly what. When the Kabuki, Mira Song, had been in wrestling for about, nearly 20 years by this point in time.
Wow.
This was a rare case. A lot of times in wrestling, you bring out who the guy really is, you know, and that's who he becomes, you know.
Right.
I want to try to make this as basic as I can. A guy like, let's say, what's a good example here? Let's say, for example, Hulk Hogan, you know.
Okay.
That's pretty much, there's not a lot of tweaking to that. You just go out there and you just turn up who you really are, you know, because he has the X factor. Like a guy like Rock. You don't really have to do much to that. You just send him out there. John Cena, you don't have to do much to it. Just like, just go out there and be yourself and just be who you are. And because the way you can best turn a guy into who he really is instead of trying to come up with a guy that we have to have, like we got to have this guy, we got to have that guy, we got to have a guy like this, got to have a guy like that. If you just say, why don't we just make this guy who he is? And if that's interesting to the people, then he'll get over. Like Hulk Hogan's a perfect example. John Cena's a perfect example. Rock, just go out there and be who you are. And it works. Kabuki was a guy who had been around for 20 years and was a Japanese guy with a short haircut. And at that time, in 1981, you know, Japan was influencing American culture. I mean, everybody had VCRs. Everybody had Walkmans. You know, everybody was driving Japanese cars. So it really was hard. The war in World War II wasn't really enough to make a guy, you know, hateable anymore. And because it was just boring by that point in time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And one night and one time, about 5-6 years before, maybe even longer than that, Dad was on a Cathay Pacific airliner, and he saw, like, they have magazines in the front of the seat in front of you on an airplane.
Yeah.
He saw a picture of a kabuki dancer, and he goes, I'd like to do something like that. So he goes, but if I can find the right guy to be that guy, if I got to find that right guy. So a few years later, he told Bruiser Brody that he was looking for about a kabuki type thing. And Bruiser went to Japan a lot, and Bruiser got out and went and worked a lot of different places. So he got exposed to a lot more people. And about 5-6 months later, Bruce called Dad. He goes, you know that kabuki thing that you were telling me about? Dad goes, yeah. Says, I think I found our boy. And so Dad went up and met Mira. And here's the real thing with this. Yeah, you had to make a guy. Yeah, they found Song Song and they turned him into kabuki and they painted him up and everything and made it all authentic. But here's the real trick. Yeah, you're going to give him the elaborate kabuki makeup and the elaborate, and you got the elaborate backstory and all this other stuff and the nunchucks and all this. But if you notice, when kabuki wrestled, he did karate-type moves.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can paint up a guy and paint his face, and if he just does hammer locks and headlocks, what is it? He has to be able to be what a kabuki would be. So
sure.
Mira understood martial arts, and he knew, because he's about a second-degree black belt in karate and judo, he understood. At first, he thought it was a rib, but then once they shelled out the money to buy the stuff, he realized they were serious. And he was he knew how to, it'd be like if you have a guy that's dressed as a samurai and he doesn't know how to use a sword. It's like if you go buy a Harley Davidson and you don't know how to ride the bike. You know, he knew, it's like you call a guy the Great Kabuki and you paint him up and make him look like a samurai and he doesn't know how to do any karate, then it looks sort of stupid.
Right.
But that was about the most elaborate thing that Dad ever did. It scared the hell out of me when I was a kid until he brought me back some Transformers from Japan. Then everything was cool.
Well, I was gonna. I mean, what's that like growing up? I mean, you had to be of age to really understand what was going on to some extent.
I knew something was up when Dad and Tim Brooks were filling condoms with green liquid and blowing the bell on a shower curtain. I knew something was up then. I said, what is that, Dad? That's a balloon.
Well, I mean, what is that like growing up the son of heel manager to, as far as everyone knows it, you know, in the public, it stopped there. He's just this villainous manager. What's it like growing up, especially in the peak of world-class championship wrestling when things, you know, right before he left the company?
I was heavy into Star Wars and all that other stuff at the time. I mean, it was cool having, I mean, I knew my dad's job was different because he did it on TV, but I just pretty much looked at him as Dad. I was interested in what he was doing, and I thought it was really cool, but it was just, I knew it was different, but because I got to go to a lot of different places, and everybody in the house, everybody would come over was a much bigger person than anybody else, physically. But it was. I knew it was cool, and I knew it was a little bit different. But to me, it was always it was a normal childhood, a good childhood, better than most. It was just really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be one of those things where it's just normal to you, and then years later, you kind of look back. I'm like, wow, boy, I guess this wasn't so normal after all.
Yeah. As the older I'm getting, I'm like, well, wait a second, you know, that didn't happen to you. You don't feel that when you drive up to a convenience store after 11 o'clock that there may be trouble. it's only been within the last six or seven months that, you know, that thought's no longer in my brain. Because, I mean, I was leaving the radio network a couple of nights, about 4 or 5 months ago, and I pulled up to get some gas, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a second, why are you on edge here? I went, those days are over, because you would leave the arena sometime, and Dad, to prove how straight he was, after you'd leave, I mean, because there used to be 5 or 6 liquor stores around the sports room. The liquor stores are still there. The building isn't. After the matches, Dad would pull up to go get some beer, and there'd be people still coming out of the building who were still hot from what you had done, you know, whether you blinded Fritz Von Erich or put one of the Von Erich brothers to sleep or you hit Bruiser Brody with a chair or something. They were still hot, you know?
Yeah.
They'll be like, oh, God, what's going to happen now? And then, so that's the way it used to be. Now it's like, well, come on, Chase, calm down.
Well, as you got older, did you encounter any issues with, like, classmates in school?
Everybody thought it was – see, that's the one thing. They may be mad at you in the arena, but when they see you and you're out and you're not in that moment, they're happy to see you.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, but as far – I mean, the kids always thought it was cool, like, for, like, what do they used to call it back then? It was, like, public schools week or something that we used to have. And when the parents would come in, so when Dad would come in, everybody was like, always like, oh, look, it's Gary Hart. In all honesty, most of my friends, you know, they didn't really treat me really any differently.
Sure.
You know? I mean, there was a few times where I would have to get in a fight, because I would be getting in fights occasionally, either from, I'd be fighting somebody who said it was fake or somebody who thought it was too real. You know? So I threw with a myriad of young people over that. Somebody would believe what they saw, and then somebody would say, that's fake. I'd say, no, it's not. I said, how fake was that? Bam!
So you're protecting the business back in those
days. Yeah, but I mean, for God's sake, I grew up watching Kevin Von Erich and Bruiser Brody. I thought it was a shoot. I thought that at least the punches were a shoot, and with them, it was.
Did you ever, I mean, as a kid, did you ever question your dad, like, hey, you know, I kind of like these Von Erichs. Why are you so mean to them?
No, because they were always, you know, I knew them, so it wasn't, you see, that's the bizarre thing. I was into it, and I thought that all the punches were, actually, because here you had to work stiff. I mean, I always knew that it was okay. You know, I had a clue when Kevin and Carrie and David would sometimes show up at the house, and then when Brody would be sleeping on the couch, I'd say, okay.
you were never petrified, like you walk out and here's this dad who just beat, you know, here's this guy who just beat the heck out of my dad, and he's sleeping on my couch.
No, because what I would do is, because when I'd be in the dressing room, they'd come back, and then Carrie, and then they'd come over and say, thanks, baby. No, thank you. You know, that would be the way. That was beautiful. That's the way it would end. I mean, you come back from after the match would be over, they'd be in the dressing room. Carrie would come over and say, Uncle Carrie, thank you. No, thank you, my boy. I'm like, okay, everything's fine. I mean, and I really knew, and this would have ruined kayfabe for everybody else except for me. Anybody else, they wouldn't have done this in front of. You remember at Texas Stadium 85 when Gino and Chris took the chain and smashed the hell out of that windshield that Kevin's team had won? Well, Gino had cut the hell out of his hand with that chain. I mean, because they went, and I'm surprised Kevin didn't cut his foot up. You know, he's walking around Texas Stadium turf with, there's glass shattered all over the place. Gino grabs the chain. Gino and Chris, Gino takes the chain. He really smashes that windshield. And then Chris jumps up and he starts kicking in the windshield. And then they run off. And then I'm standing there in the foyer of Texas Stadium, and there's Kevin, Carrie, Gino, and Chris standing there, and Kevin and Carrie going, man, Gino, brother, you all right? No, man, I cut the fuck out of my hand, man. And I'm standing right there, and they're not even reacting. It's like, okay, yeah, they know, okay, no, that was me when I was 6, you know. I told Dad, I said, you know, they didn't even react to it. Dad goes, well, they know who you are. That's why they didn't say anything.
Right.
Because I'm standing right there, and that's like, I mean, anybody else, that would have blown their mind. You know, any other kid that would have snuck in, that would have blown their mind. But I'm standing there, it's like, it has no effect. I mean, it's like, I know it's okay. Yeah.
Well, did you ever have to have the talk with your dad? And I'm not talking about the usual father-son talk about the birds and the bees, but just, you got to protect the business, son.
That was done in a way to where, and I always kind of knew, that's why I'm surprised business draws now, because I always swore to God as soon as the cat got out, as soon as we started admitting it, I thought it'd be over.
Yeah.
It might soon be. But it was just always, I can't remember exactly, I think it was something said like, this goes no further than here, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
what's discussed here, that this doesn't go any further, we got to protect this. But it was said in a way like that, like how you would tell a child, like, oh, no, you know. But I always kind of figured, all right, if people don't believe this, we may have a problem drawing money. But it was kind of done in that way of, well, if it's done in front of you, you don't think anything of it. So
yeah.
it was in an underlined way, it was like, this stays here, you know, that kind of thing. This is our thing, you know. But it wasn't beat into me. It was just told to me once or twice of, this doesn't go any further. Okay. And I was like, okay. And I was little, and I understood, okay, we got to draw money. You know, this is business. We got to draw money, so we got to keep this up. But, I mean, I was, you know, I loved Brody, and I loved the Von Erichs. And it was just it was just different for me. I mean, I just understood, okay, we got to protect this. We can't say anything.
How far did he go with it? Like, you know, if you had a friend over and he knows Bruce Brody's coming over, or Von Erich, anybody he's feuding with is stopping by the house, was it time for that friend to leave?
Well, the Von Erichs didn't really come over that much because you know, people would talk, you know, over the Von Erichs. Now, Brody would, but again, Brody was worse than Dad, you know. Bruce would come to the house and he'd say, you don't think anybody saw me, did they? And they would say, Bruce, it's fine, you know. Like, yeah, they may think something strange that you're walking around and you're walking in the back of the apartment complex, you know, sneaking around the back way. They may say, yeah, that may draw some attention to you. But Bruce was like really paranoid with that too. So with that, but you know, normally if you don't make an issue of it, no one's really going to say anything, you know.
Sure. You've mentioned the Von Erichs several times, and
greatest gift my dad ever had.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just the tragedy that is world class, and I know your dad, granted the interview that was one of the major parts. I cut throughout the heroes of world class.
The Triumph and Tragedy of World Class by WB.
That's right. Well, I actually just watched the other one. It was I'd seen that one in the past, but after reading your dad's book, I was kind of inspired to.
The Heroes of World Class.
Yeah.
I thought that the WWE version, and I know a lot of people don't like them, and I have no problem with them, but I thought that the WWE version was I think that really encompassed the entire thing. I think that put that really summed it all up for me. The only part I didn't like was acting like Kerry Von Erich was just some last-second stand-in. I think he was painted in a less than flattering light.
Boy, it's been so many years since I saw that version. And I like I said, I just saw the Heroes. But one thing that stood out from watching your dad's interview, even at that point in his life, all these years removed from it, it still hurt. All the tragedy that company went through with the, mm-hmm. you know, the loss of all but Kevin Von Erich and the loss mm-hmm. of Chris Adams and Gino Hernandez, I know, is someone that your father was close with. Were you old enough to kind of comprehend something's not right with some of these guys? Could you kind of see them going downhill, or were you just at that age where you didn't really pick up on it?
Well, I think maybe that's the reason why I never got into drugs.
Really?
You know, because by the time I was like, my God, 12, I had known people who had serious drug problems, and it beat them, you know?
Hmm.
And the drug thing was never hidden from me, because when Gino had died, I didn't know why, but within a couple of days, they had told me that you know, he OD'd. And, like, when Mike went missing, what happened? He OD'd, you know? And it was just never hidden from me that there was a drug problem and that drugs will kill you. And the thing with Gino is, this is the God's honest truth. Dad didn't start to talk about Gino or open up about him until about the last 4 or 5 years of his life.
Really?
Because, I mean, it was like almost after 86, after Gino died, he really wasn't mentioned again. I'm not over exaggerating here. It's sort of like how, like, if a family loses a child, sometimes the kid doesn't get talked about because of the pain.
Sure.
That was in a lot of ways for my dad. And I just remember after that had happened, Dad was very, very somber for several months and didn't really talk that much. And then it took him a while, and he finally got out of it. But Gino really didn't get talked about that much until about the last 4 or 5 years of Dad's life. And still, even then, I mean, the last he was doing a convention in Allentown, Pennsylvania, about a day or two before he died, and then the topic of Gino came up again. And Dad they had to take a break during the convention because Dad just couldn't hold it together. So, I mean, that was a very painful thing, as was David Von Erich and Kerry Von Erich. I mean, it wasn't like so much like guys you work with. I mean, they were like his nephews. With the exception of my brother and me, Dad would not have traded the Von Erichs or Gino in for anything.
Yeah, and it's not like he was just around the Von Erichs as wrestlers. I mean, he certainly played a huge part in their development. In fact, he was the
one. There was a lot there to develop, too, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, and he was the one who said, correct me if I'm wrong, that Kevin's ready. Fritz was, you know, very apprehensive.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, he knew Kevin was ready. But knew them, before, you know, when they were kids.
He used to take them to get haircuts.
Yeah, he was Uncle Gary to them.
Yeah, exactly. Because they didn't have any uncles.
Wow. So, I mean, this
was... Except for Waldo, their kayfabe uncle.
Right.
Wish somebody would lock Lance in a, I don't know.
I felt really bad when your dad was... Did you ever talk with him? Because I know one of his issues from reading the book was that people kind of pointed to, well, you smoke weed. Because he was very open with smoking marijuana, deal. But that was kind of...
I actually saw him do it a few times.
But, I mean, that seemed like it was kind of held against him at different points in his career, like when he would try to say something to Fritz about what his boys were doing, and Fritz would go back to that, almost like, well, you know, how can you say it? I mean, to me, there's pot, and then there's everything else that's harder.
Exactly,
it seemed like your dad had some issues with that. Like, he Fritz's words shouldn't have hurt him, but I think they did.
In some ways, he thought to himself, maybe if I didn't, they wouldn't. Because he saw nothing wrong with it. You know, it has some effects, and if you have to, and, I mean, it's a plant; it just grows that way. And if you set it on fire, there are a few side effects. But
right.
In some ways. He thought that maybe maybe they would have listened to him more had he not smoked, you know.
That was one of the things though that your dad pointed to in the book also is that when he was the booker, the matchmaker, when he was in charge of that locker room, it wasn't tolerated, and he made that
it
very clear
no.
to them.
To be honest with you, they make it. Some people, the revisionist history has a real way of becoming fact.
Sure.
They make it like it was a nonstop party here, and apparently there was a problem because so many of them are no longer here, but that wasn't a factor when Dad was the matchmaker. You know, Dad had a rule. He goes, do whatever you want to before you get here, but when you come here, there were a few times where guys weren't right, and they didn't get to work.
Right.
You know? I mean, it didn't affect anything. Yeah, it affected a lot of things because guys died. It's not like they went off to another territory; they're gone. They're not coming back. But as far as being no shows and all this other stuff, even when it became a slight problem later, it was never to the level that they make it. But yeah, if you can't, I mean, when Dad was doing it, when Dad was running things. They never. There was never that problem because if you were trashed or high, you weren't going to the ring. It wasn't happening. There's no reason to. Because Dad's whole thing was okay. Well, if you show up, he goes, well, you're not going to tell my dad, are you? Well, no, you're going to have to tell your dad why you weren't on TV. You know, so that pretty much. And Kevin and Kerry and David, they would never. I mean, they weren't. I mean, they're kind of portrayed like. And I think Kevin said that they were a little reckless and they were a little wild, yeah. But they were, they weren't, you know, drugged out and, you know, they just weren't. They didn't do it in front of everybody. You know, was there a problem? Yeah, there was a few problems, but it was never to the extent that they make it. And I'm not just saying this because I love the Von Erichs, but if they were so trashed, how'd they draw all that money?
Well, you know, I found it interesting, too. There was one part of the book where he walked in on, I believe it was members, you know, members of the Von Erich family and some of the Freebirds.
And the Freebirds, yes.
And then, yeah. Was it cocaine that they were using in part of the sportatorium?
It was actually in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And they were, it was in Houston, was it Houston or San Antonio, one of the two. And they were up on the, and thank God it was my dad and not the cop who used to patrol the dressing room.
Right.
Dad went up there, goes, "What are you guys doing?" And Terry Gordy's like, "Oh, Gary, I'm so sorry, I love it." Dad was like, "Then you straighten yourself out, you know?" And he Dad was like, "How's this going to look? You guys are in a program together, and you're up here doing this." And Dad was like, "This doesn't, you know, we can't be doing this." Had it been anybody else, he'd have fired them right on the spot. And
sure.
I think they maybe thought, and I think maybe they thought when he walked in that they would, that he was going to say, "Hey boys, isn't this cute?" You know, because he's Uncle Gary.
Right.
But then as soon as he walked in, they were like, "Oh," and they're like, "Oh no, he's upset." You know. But no, that was one. I mean, did that kind of stuff go on here? And after Dad left, I don't know. But when Dad was running things, no. But I mean, I want to emphasize one more. I mean. Were there drug problems here? Yeah, because everybody, most of them, a lot of them aren't here anymore, but were they all drugged out and crazy and wild? Not to the extent where it affected their, where they were no-showing and all this other stuff, no.
Well, I mean,
they were all good guys, and they were just hurting themselves.
Yeah, and that's one thing that came through in the book, is I think one of the messages your dad really wanted to send is that, you know, the Von Erichs ended up having their problems, but they weren't always like this.
They were good kids.
But I'm curious, we'll never know, but do you think that if your dad and Fritz hadn't had that falling out that led to your dad leaving and Ken Mantell taking over, if your dad had stayed in the same capacity with World Class, do you think there's a chance that we wouldn't be talking about all of the Von Erich tragedies, or were they just unavoidable?
Well, I think it's freedom of choice. You know, I mean, you can't watch somebody 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I think it's just freedom of choice. I think in some ways, maybe life is when you have everything that they had, as far as the popularity and the screaming girls and all the other stuff. After you leave the ring, maybe life is just too boring. You know, you got to have something to keep the rush going. Maybe that's the answer.
I think it's a lot like
rock stars. You know, pretty much. I mean, how many rock stars have went down that same path? Like, God, he's got everything. He's got the money. He's got the cars. He's got the women. But then, the show only lasts 2 hours. You know, you got to have something to go on for the. I mean, I think that Dad being, I'm not really too sure. I think that what you choose to do is what you choose to do. To be completely honest with you, I think that thinking that my dad leaving caused all of that, or that could have been prevented. I think that may be a bit of a reach.
Okay,
but I do think Ken Mantell was very, very, very destructive, though, in the way he went about things.
Sure, you know, I just wondered if because of the influence that your dad clearly had over the Von Erichs, you know, he was the Uncle Gary to them, and so I was just curious if he thought.
And unfortunately, he had a lot of influence over Gino, but couldn't save him.
Right, right. And believe me, we're only scratching the surface on this. We're not covering we're covering a fraction of what is in Playboy Gary Hart, My Life in Wrestling, with a little help from my friends. Again, available at playboygaryhart.net. Highly recommended. As I said earlier, I think it's the best book that probably 99% of you listening to this have yet to read, and I can't recommend it enough. With the whole Von Erich legacy and the Freebirds, did your dad, did he keep in touch with Kevin and Michael,
yeah,
really the surviving guys from those two factions? And I guess,
yeah,
Obviously Buddy also.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, the day before he passed away, and the last time I talked to Michael Hayes, it was about a week after Dad passed away. Michael felt really bad, but because Dad, as soon as he got off the airplane, told me in chat, he goes, "I left a message on Michael Hayes' machine saying, 'I guess now because you're a vice president, you don't have time to talk to me.'"
Oh no!
And Michael said that he saw that he didn't recognize the number, and he would have answered the phone and he knew it was Dad. And then
that's too bad.
And because Michael called me like about a week later, he goes, Jason, God, man, I feel hard. I said, Michael, he thought it was funny. So
right.
he kept in contact with me. And to be completely honest with you, as soon as I got back from the hospital the day the dad passed away, Kevin Von Erich was the first person I called.
Oh wow!
And had it not been for Kevin, I swear to God, I would not have been able to have gotten through it. Because I told Kevin, I said, you know, when I was a little kid, I always knew when this day was going to come that that you were the one I was going to need.
Really?
And yeah. And had it not been for him, I mean, because he was Johnny on the spot. He was right there.
And
he called a couple times a week, made sure I was all right. I had because, you know, if anybody knows what losing someone is like and was losing somebody close to you, had it not been for him, I wouldn't have been able to get through it. He was my rock.
Oh, that's tremendous. And I mean, one of the things that we were talking to Michael Hayes, your dad actually, who is still working with WWE, he's no longer the head writer of SmackDown. He's actually in a different position that they've created with probably more stroke than he had before. Your dad had a couple of flirtations, I guess we could call them, with WWE, but it seemed like there were some people in the company that were playing games with him.
And at which time?
Well, I guess both times it came across. Like, you know, the first time he went up there, correct me if I'm wrong, I might have the occasions confused, but I know it was Chief J. Strongbow.
Yeah.
That seemed like he was messing with your dad based on some issues they had prior to that.
Yeah, from Atlanta when Dad fired him in the before he got back to the dressing room. At that point in time, I mean, there were good guys there, you know, real stand-up guys. I mean, real good guys. I mean, like Gorilla Monsoon was there, George Steele was there, Pat Patterson was there. Good guys, you know, real men. Arnold Skolin, real. I mean, top shelf people. But then also there was the other contingent of locker room lawyers, dressing room politicians, you know.
Right.
Guys who have the answer to everything for everybody's problems, can get everybody over but can't get themselves out of the third match, you know, that kind of thing. There was a lot of type of guys. I mean, there were a lot of guys like that there too, and Dad just didn't really like and they kind of liked that, because if the dressing room's mad at each other, then they can't really be mad at the office, you know.
Sure.
So back then they kind of liked that. And there was a lot of locker room lawyers and dressing room politicians. I mean, there were good people there. There was like the Randy Savages, there was the Hulk Hogans, the Roddy Pipers, the Don Morocco's, the Arnold Skolins, the Gorilla Monsoons, class acts. So those kind of guys, but then there was also the other, and Dad didn't really want to, you know, play in that environment. And Dad was a lot like me. He was a feel guy. If something didn't feel right, it was like, I don't think I need to be here. So he came back here and helped turn Paul McCartney into Keith Richards, basically turning Chris Adams heel.
Right.
The whole thing would never happen had Mr. Fuji. I said, do you have any of that stuff with you? Dad was like, oh, come on, please.
Oh, that's right. Fuji played games with him too, didn't he?
Oh yeah, yeah, lots of games.
That's a shame. Did we should definitely talk about his other great creation. I mean, you mentioned him putting the mask, you know, coming up with. I guess tell me how much. I know he came up with the idea of putting. Well, he came up with the idea of the spoiler, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because I know he put the mask on Don Jardine, and the
yep.
rest is history. And but
that's,
actually,
and that's what made him. That's what broke him. That's what made him.
Yeah, so
made both of them. It made Fritz Von Erich a successful promoter. Made my dad a successful matchmaker and a successful booker. And it made Uncle Donald a big name.
And going back even further, very early,
that's the real Lynch. The world class starts right there.
Going back even further in your dad's career, in the very early days, there was a character that he had some involvement in that it didn't become what the wrestler was most famous for. But tell us about the student.
Oh, George. Oh, George Steele.
Yeah.
Well, George was Jim Myers. He only wrestled, you know, on the weekends and during the summer because he was a school teacher and a football coach. And so Dad just said, let's put a mask on him and just call him the student. And then they had a chance to go to Australia, and Dad goes, we're going to go to Australia. And Jim goes, I'm not going anywhere. I got to teach school. And Dad was like, oh, well, hell. So Australia came up a few years later. So yeah, and the student, yeah, I mean, yeah, he wasn't tearing up turnbuckles and saying mine and all that other stuff, but he was pretty good.
Yeah,
because I mean, he had to wear a mask. You couldn't. I mean, he's teaching school. You had to, you know, kind of hide him. There was a deal. Dad taught him how to get over, and he taught Dad how to drive. Because Dad had brought a brand new convertible. Had no idea how to drive. And George says, "I'm going to show you how to drive." Because you bought that, you don't know how to drive. Dad goes, "No, I don't know how to drive." He goes, "Okay, you show me how to get over, and I'll show you how to drive." So any tickets or that Dad may have had, that's all on George Steele.
Perfect. And of course, you know, I think as many people these days, probably more people these days, even though he had so much success with the spoiler.
I think I know where this is going.
Yeah, of course. And the great Kabuki, there was one other that I think most people associate your dad with that he really molded and created in a similar way as Kabuki, and that would be the great Muta.
Kenji Muta.
Yeah, and it was another guy that didn't, you know, again, growing up, I was starting to get into the newsletters and whatnot around that time. Must have been a little bit after, though, because I didn't know the story. Again, I just assumed, here's this guy who's had tremendous success in Japan, and now he's coming over to the United States.
Well, that's what you were supposed to think.
Yeah, but it wasn't like that, was it?
No, absolutely not. Well, Kenji had been around for about 7 or 8 years by that point in time. And this is going back to that thing. Dad saw him do things. And Dad was like, what would Kabuki's son be like? You know? Because I swear to God, I remember the exact day where the idea was hatched. I was sitting right there when it happened. Al Perez, who I love to death, had an issue with Ric Flair and the Turner whole takeover and everything like that, and had walked away from what had become WCW to work in Florida and go to New York, and then came back to Texas. Dad had got a phone call, and we're living in Daytona Beach at the time, and I just got off of school, and I'm playing with my G.I. Joes or something, and the phone rings, and Dad picks up the phone, because Dad was on hiatus pretty much at the time, you know. What they were doing is the managers were making TV, and they were sending you a check for two grand a week, so you get a check for $4,000 every 2 weeks to do absolutely nothing. That's why he gained so much weight, because all he was doing was smoking weed and drinking wine with Kevin Sullivan, who lived up the just up the beach a bit. None of that ever happened. I'm just assuming that's what they were doing. The phone rang, and Dad picked up the phone. He goes, yes, George. George Scott was on the other end of the line, who was the matchmaker at the time. And Dad was like, uh-huh, mm-hmm. Well, I can make you something similar. Now, everything's got to be authentic. Okay. And he hung up the phone. I said, what was that about? And Dad looks at me and goes, they want another Kabuki. And I was like, okay. And there were two guys. He had brought in two guys for it. You know, one didn't even, and they were both working under masks. But like what I was saying is, you let the guy inspire who he really is, who he becomes. Because Muta was doing all the, like my brother said to me, he goes, Muta was doing backflips before Dad found him? I can't believe it. I said, why do you think he got the job? You know, what was Dad going to do, moonsaults and all that stuff? No, but Dad saw him, and Dad had seen him around a few times. And I said, who's it going to be? Dad goes, there's a boy in Texas that I think might be the right one. And Kenji did the flips, and he was Kenji was about 6'3" and had a good head of hair back then anyway.
Yeah.
I know now maybe different. But now he looks like Dad now, if Dad were Japanese. Oh, look like Gary's son now. it's like what would Kabuki's son be like? He would be a good looking guy, a big guy, but totally different from his dad, and he could do all these amazing things. Because Kabuki, that's the thing that was the problem with the WCW office. They kept thinking Kabuki. This is not Kabuki. Dad would say, he's Kabuki, he's Muta. He's not Kabuki, he's Muta. He's completely different. Because they'd be in the office, and they'd be wanting him to do things. They was like, you don't understand, he's Muta, not Kabuki, completely different. And after a while, they would ask Kenji to do things, and Kenji would say, I am Muta, completely different. he was. I mean, and that was the thing. It was like a superhero with a bad guy, because if you remember Kabuki was like, I mean, let's say if we're going to have a match, let's say, for instance, in modern times, you're going to say, okay, we need somebody to work with The Undertaker.
Yeah.
You would pick Kabuki. You wouldn't pick Muta. Because,
sure.
I mean, you had Kabuki working with Jimmy Valiant, and I love Jimmy Valiant, but Muta, No, you could not book Muta with Jimmy Valiant because you're not going to have Muta in a bloodbath-type match.
Right.
Dusty Rhodes would not go well with Muta. Why? Because it would have to be a bloodbath. The Ultimate Warrior, yeah, you could put him with either one. You're going to have Kevin Nash work with one of them. You have him with Kabuki because it's going to be a bloodbath and it's going to be really violent. You would book Shawn Michaels with Muta, that kind of thing. And the office, the only real similarity between the two of them was face paint and green mist. Other than that, there really wasn't a whole lot of similarities. It's like if you were going to book the Road Warriors with one of them, you'd book them with Kabuki. You wouldn't book them with Muta. Like if you're going to book Hulk Hogan, you'd book Hulk Hogan with Muta. You wouldn't book him with Kabuki.
And your father.
They were really completely different, as Kenji would say, because Dad would say, they don't understand, he's Kabuki, not Muta. I mean, I am Muta, completely different.
Well, and that was one of the things your dad really enjoyed doing, was finding that young talent and molding them. It didn't just, here's your character, go do your thing.
Because then it's not going to work, because it's like a lot of times, like what WWE does right now, they're of a mindset where we got to find this guy. I mean, they're trying to recreate Austin. You know, you can't recreate Steve Austin. Steve Austin just is that way. You can't recreate the NWO. That'd be like trying to recreate the Freebirds. It's just, if it's there, then let it go. But don't, I mean, they try to pigeonhole and box a guy in, saying, we got to come up with this kind of guy, instead of saying, this guy is this guy. Let's let him be that guy. Yeah?
Gotcha. And was it, Kabuki was the one that your father kind of had a falling out with, correct?
Yes.
And did they ever make amends?
I guess in some way. He hadn't talked to Kabuki in, I think, 86 was about the one he worked here with Abdullah in 86. And that probably been the last time they probably talked. But Guy didn't have any ill will towards Kabuki, I think. Because, I mean, occasionally, even after the falling out, when they brought him back here with Sunshine, he would come to Dad and say, get a son. Dad be like, don't do what you're not comfortable with. Dad, I mean, Kabuki was a typical Japanese wrestler. He was afraid of what the Zaibatsu or boss would say. And he caught hell from his girlfriend after that. She was like, how do you walk away from Gary like that? If it's not for Gary, you're still Takachiyo. So I'm not exactly too sure Kabuki was just, he was afraid that word would get back to Baba that he wasn't doing what the boss wanted him to do. And Dad found that to be true with almost every Japanese guy that he ever managed.
Wow.
And then I always found that to be bizarre, but that's the way it happened.
And how about Muta? What was the relationship like between those two?
Afterwards?
Yeah.
The last time Dad talked to him, in all honesty, was February of 90.
Wow.
That would have been right before he went back to Japan. Dad just told him, he goes, take care of the gimmick, because it's all you have. And he goes, you'll go back to Japan, and you'll be Hulk Hogan. And that's who he became. But no, I love Kenji. He was like the Japanese foreign exchange student that came to live with us for the summer.
that's pretty much
what he was. Loved him to death. Still do.
Yeah, I mean, how long did he stay with you guys?
Well, he wasn't actually living with us. But you know, we were living in a hotel suite type situation.
Right.
So, and he was living right downstairs from us. So he'd be we'd go out to eat, he'd come with us, you know. Like when they were home and when they weren't on a 70-day excursion, you know. Yeah, we'd make road trips with him. Yeah, he was like.
Man, oh man.
He was a trip too, man, let me tell you. But he was just really figuring, I mean, he took to the Muta thing like a duck to water, and he was just really figuring it out and getting it together. And then they wanted to start, they couldn't understand, they wanted to turn him babyface, but they couldn't understand that he already was a babyface.
Right.
They were like, well, Gary, you're with me. It doesn't make any difference. They couldn't understand it. I always thought the cool way for him to go out, for Dad to go out would be like, let Muta have the belt and just start booking him with other heels, and then after about a year, go ahead and just call it a career. Because, I mean, if they would have wanted to turn him babyface, which he already was a babyface, if they would have just came to Dad and say, hey, Gary, is it all right if we start booking him with heels? Does it? Fine, go ahead. You know, the people are already carrying him anyway. It doesn't really matter. But yeah, that was about that whole time period was about the only time where Dad actually brought work home and was upset. You know.
Okay.
I mean, he was. I mean, that was the last. Dad said it best. I brought him a toy, and they were mad at me.
Well, and this was the insane Jim Herd era, correct?
Oh God Almighty! This I think Ric Flair said it best. You know, it was. I mean, he wanted Ric Flair to chop his hair off and put a diamond earring and make him a Spartacus character. So if I ever see Jim Herd, I will smack him just on those grounds alone. Messing with Ric Flair, don't be doing that, man.
This question, I think people who have read the book already, this is for them. Are you still comfortable letting anyone other than Brute Bernard hold you?
Well, it depends. It depends if you're an attractive young African American woman. Yeah, then I'm comfortable with anything, sure.
And the reason I bring that up is you go ahead and tell the story. I know your dad alluded to it in the book.
Oh, well, there's a picture of me there with Brute Bernard, and I would cry pretty much if anybody else picked me up. I'd stop crying whenever he'd pick me up, yeah? That was the way. Maybe I thought it was Dad. No, well, Dad hadn't shaved his head completely yet, so, maybe it was a sign of things to come. I don't know.
One of the final things I want to talk about is and long after World Class,
I want to say that my baby pictures do set off the book, you know, if nothing else.
There you go. Well, long after World Class and after the World Championship Wrestling run, your dad helped. Well, he got involved briefly with Major League Wrestling, had formed a relationship with Court Bauer, mm-hmm. and Court went on to, of course, write for World Wrestling Entertainment. And I know Court has told me that at one time, he was working, I think he actually presented it, but there was a strong, I'm pretty sure he made a strong pitch to actually bring in your father. Do you know that story?
Yeah. Court wanted a lot. When Court had come up with a few ideas, and Dad had thrown a few things in his way, and Dad was like, don't tell him that I'm coming up with anything for you. You know, don't let him know this. Because I think they ended up using one thing that Dad had come up with. It was supposed to be for the Giant, but it's when they had, like, when it was ended up with Sean and the drug test or something.
Yeah.
It was supposed to originally be for the Giant, but they ended up using it for Sean. And it is like one of those things where you throw out an idea and they take it and then they change it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, Dad was pretty much past that. He didn't want to really do that anymore. And Court had really made an effort to try to get him to come in. But Dad was like, I'm like 60 now, and I want to spend the remainder of my time with my kids, and I don't really want to be doing that anymore.
Sure, sure. And then
he just pretty much wanted to live out he was never really seriously ill. He just didn't want to, you know. It's like, I've done all that, son. You know, I was like, oh, I understand completely, and in all honesty, I'm kind of glad he didn't, because I wouldn't have had him as long as I did. I mean, but yeah, Court had made a real pitch after that, but Dad was like, I don't want to do that, not anymore.
And if I don't remember all the details, so maybe you can help me out. It was a pretty interesting idea, and I think one of the main ones that Court was pushing for was a character based loosely on Kill Bill. The movie.
Yeah, it was something with the Japanese, something with an Asian girl or something like that.
Yeah, you wanted your dad wearing, like, the long flowing robes and just kind of playing this this boss character. I think he wanted to call it, like, was it Black Moon?
Yeah, it was Black Label, not Black Label Society. Black Friday Management or something like that.
Yeah,
where Dad was going to be in a pimp suit and in an Armani and have an Asian girl. Let me do that then, okay? just give me the Asian. Just give me Gail Kim and tell me I don't have to show up on TV.
Hey, there you go. Well,
yes.
Your brother did get into wrestling. Is that something that you've had aspirations to do? I know that you did. You even know that you were booking shows by using your action figures at one time?
No, I just thought I was having a good time. And now what I would like to do is like to buy some WWE action figures and book the show I'm not seeing.
There you go.
But now, did I have any aspirations to get in the business, to be a wrestler? Yeah, when I was a kid. But when I was 15 and I realized that I was only going to be about 5'11 and only weighed 126, and thank God still weigh the same thing to this day, I realized, okay, it ain't going to be me. Because, I mean, if I was going to be in the wrestling business, there was only one job I wanted. I wanted to either be Ric Flair or I wanted to be Shawn Michaels. And once I realized that I wasn't going to be physically able to do that, I mean, I look pretty good with my shirt off, but granted, I'm only 125 pounds. If I couldn't be Ricky or Shawn, then that's what I wanted to be, and it didn't end up happening. But I'm fine with that. And then that's when I decided, okay, I'm skinny. I want to be Tommy Lee. That didn't work out either.
Tommy Lee of Motley Crue fame. You and I bonded over our love of 80s metal before we started doing this interview. But so the creative side of things, that just, even though it was so much of what your dad did, that just didn't appeal to you?
Oh, yeah, it does appeal to me. But nowadays I look at things for what they could be, not what they are. And to be honest with you, I think that the talent situation that's in wrestling right now is very, very bad, and I don't see where any new guys are coming from, because, I mean, there's a few guys right now that are very, very good. John Cena is outstanding. I like Sheamus a whole lot. I think he's very good. There's another young guy there named Mason Ryan who I think is very, very good. I think Alberto Del Rio. I think Alberto Del Rio is very, very good. I think that a guy like CM Punk, I'm not really too sure what that's all about. I mean, I'm seeing them push a lot of guys like The Miz and CM Punk, guys who I don't really see much of anything in.
Really?
And then I see other guys like Sheamus, who really starts to get established. And what do? They have midgets like Evan Bourne and that other guy beat him up. So, I mean, they tore down Khali as they were building him. I mean, it's it's a really complex. I mean, to me, it's second nature because I've grown up around it. Not only because I'm Gary Hart's kid, but also because I'm Gary Hart's kid. I got the DNA, and I have from the conversation I've had with him. And after about 34 years, you see a lot of stuff, you know. So everything's you've seen this before. And Triple H, I love him, and I think that he would better serve us actually wrestling in the ring. That's where I think he needs to be. And does he have a prolific mind for wrestling? Yes, but no one cares who's running it. We need to have a build-up for a match. I mean, they had The Rock, and they had John Cena, and they ignored it. And they were hell-bent on going with The Miz and The Rock. And then when they announced John and Rock for next year's WrestleMania, it didn't get near what it was getting the week before. I think that John and Rock would have been something really, really cool, and would have been really what we, because when Rock came back, it was hot again. He was interesting. He had the people. I think maybe it's a scenario, it's one of those situations where he got over too strong. But I mean, as far as guys there, Triple H, I love him to death. I've never met him, hope to one day. He's the best I've seen since Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels. You have him. You have Sheamus, you have John Cena, you have Randy Orton, you have Mason Ryan, and a couple other guys. But the guys that they're going with, The Miz, the CM Punks of the world, not really. I don't really see what the fascination is there. And also the young talent problem. You can't take a guy out of a wrestling school, which is basically what Florida Championship Wrestling is, and expect them to be able to perform on a national level. You know, I mean, you can't get a guy, if you have a guy who's been wrestling for a year and he's wrestling another guy that's been wrestling for 9 months, that's not really going to get it. Like, if you look at the Von Erichs, I mean, look at who they were booked with. I mean, they were good-looking, great athletes and had natural ability anyway. And then you put them with Mark Lewin and the Spoiler and Harley Race and Ric Flair, then they get even better.
Right.
And we don't have that now.
It sounds to me like you like it's more the muscular guy. I mean, because you're like,
oh well, what are you trying to say?
Well, you're like the only guy that I've heard that's endorsed the idea of Mason Ryan. Most people like send him back down. He's terrible. But,
well, because he was never really trained.
Yeah.
And another guy who I thought was very, very good was Chris Masters, but he just got there too early, and he's doing too many different things. And it's not so much a muscle thing. It's just like. Like a guy like X-Pac. Let's take X-Pac for example.
Sure.
not a super heavyweight at all.
Right.
But when you see him, you don't think cruiserweight because he don't work like a cruiserweight. He works like a main eventer.
Yeah, he's
you know?
Put together.
I mean, but if you watch his work, the way he works in the ring, he can do the flying around stuff. But that, but he doesn't do that kind of stuff. He does the stuff that draws money. Like if you look at that, I mean, they would be. I mean, they want to put CM Punk with John Cena, please. You know, if you put X-Pac with John Cena, then you got some because X-Pac, yeah, he's not the biggest guy out there, but he works like a main eventer. And then you got other big guys there, like that Wade Barrett.
Yeah.
You know, he don't work like a big guy. You know, like Kevin Nash was saying, they got big guys there that don't even work like big guys. I mean, I've seen big guys try to throw drop kicks off the top rope. What are you doing that for? You know?
Right. Yeah. Just you know, I think some guys try to go against the grain. It's like they
which you can't do. I mean, because it's like you have to be. It's like I would ask them. Like, let's say you ask a guy. Let's say I would pull a guy like. Let's say I pull a guy off the side and say, "Who was your favorite wrestler when you were a kid?" I mean, they all say they love Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels, but I'm not seeing it in their work because they don't work anything like them. I mean, the reason Nikki Six did heroin is because Joe Perry and Steven Tyler did it.
Sure.
But you would ask a guy, say, let me ask, who was your favorite wrestler?
Mine growing up?
Yes, who was your favorite wrestler?
Oh, God, as a kid, it had to be Hulk Hogan.
Okay, well, what did you like about Hulk Hogan? What did you want to see him do?
Just the energy, the charisma. I mean, there just was. Because I got Hogan before the WWF, being in Minnesota. I mean,
right.
The AWA really felt like the birthplace of Hulkamania. That's
which it was.
Really
which
started.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
You know, people,
thanks to Larry Zbyszko.
Thanks to Zbyszko. How so?
Yeah. Well, he was the one who told because when he was when Hulk was working for the McMahons and in the late 70s, early 80s, doing jobs for Andre. They all saw him as a monster heel, you know, because he was the only one big enough to put in the ring with Andre.
Right.
And then Larry encouraged him to go someplace else, go work for the Ganyas, and, you know, be a babyface and start just being a heel for Andre to knock around. But he was smart enough to go with it.
I've told my listeners this before. One of the, you know, you mentioned this the stiff style they used in Texas. Growing up a fan of the AWA back in, you know, the Young Mark days, and even when you got to that point where it's like, you're at that age where, yeah, it's probably not real, but you don't want to admit it to yourself. Well, mm-hmm. Me and my friends, probably 6th, 7th grade, we got to the point where we were willing to admit that what we were seeing in the AWA was staged. Mm-hmm. Oh, but that world-class stuff we were seeing on Channel 29 in syndication with the Von Erichs and Freebirds, that was real.
Yeah, and you would have been right if you would have been in there with them. Like Jimmy Garvin said, we had the one rule, don't break my nose, don't blind my eyes, try to knock my teeth out. Other than that, try not to kill me. But I mean, going back to what I was trying to get to here.
Yeah.
Like, let's say, let's say you're a fan of the Ultimate Warrior.
Right.
You know, let's say, what if he didn't throw clotheslines? What if he didn't pick you up and body slam you? What if he ran away from you, and took a bump on every punch? You'd say, wait a second, that's not what he's supposed to be doing. Well, then we got to make him look the way he's supposed to look.
I get
you
what
know?
You're saying.
That's going to a point of like having somebody work against type. You know, it's like if you're 7 foot, why are you trying to work like you're 180? You know,
right? No,
like,
I definitely get
you,
that.
You have to make the guy look like it's like we were talking about before with Goldberg. You have to make the guy look like the people perceive him. The people see him as this. Like, the people perceive him as this, we need to make him like this. So if you're, like all these guys nowadays, they all try to work the same. There's no variation in their work because they're not exposed to anything else. They're not working with guys who are better. I mean, like Magnum TA said, by the time you would get to a big territory, you'd probably had about, you know, 3,000 matches under your belt by that point in time.
Sure.
But, I mean, the thing, I mean, they all work alike. They all look alike, and what is this thing with the short haircuts they've all got? I mean, I don't really care. Like Michael Hayes, you know, was he the greatest worker of all time? No, but as far as a performer, there's never been, nor will there ever be, a better performer than Michael Hayes. I mean, he just really knew how to take over and light up a crowd. You don't have that anymore.
So I mean, but you've got guys like
and he wasn't the most muscular guy either. He was like Dad. He touched the weights about as much as Dad, which was never.
Well, I agree on some points you're making. I mean, you're totally right. Barrett's here.
And this isn't meant for me to take it out on the young guys. It's just if it doesn't most of the time when I was a kid, if I would take an interest in you, you would end up doing something. I didn't even realize I was doing it. But nowadays, I see very, very few things I take an interest in. I mean, I watch maybe, if my brother didn't live with me, I probably wouldn't see any of it all.
Interesting. Okay. I really dig what they're doing with CM Punk. I mean, there's issues with it that really surfaced this week for me. And
mm-hmm.
I'm all, I enjoy the Miz's push. But I understand what you're saying.
To me, I just don't see it.
Yeah. And, everyone has a different perspective on that. Having grown up through the quote-unquote steroid era and then seeing guys like Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels.
That was my favorite era.
Yeah, so it kind of surprises me that you're having a tough time really getting into guys like Miz and Punk.
Because they don't work anything like them. You see, because to me it's not a size thing. I grew up, I hate high spots. I like to see main event style work.
Sure.
And, that's what Shawn, I always thought that 93, 94, 95 group that was in New York, that was the best group that New York had ever had. I'm not really too much into and then all this stuff with, okay, we're going to get a shot of you. And now the way it is, okay, it's all contrived. We're going to get a shot. Okay, when you go up the aisle, I want you to turn around and stare back at him. And then every time they go to the floor, they take a commercial. It's just one of those things. I'm just not really. There's a few guys there now that I'm buzzed about, but it's none of the guys they're pushing.
Gotcha. Well, to bring this back to your dad here before we wrap this.
Yes, please do. Let's chop all this WWF stuff out. I don't want to offend anybody there that I might know.
All right. Well, I would be remiss if I did not get back to the legendary blade that your father carried.
Oh, yes.
I mean, here's this guy who, like I said, he's a street smart kid from Chicago, but he's the first guy I don't know about the first guy, but he wasn't comfortable with the gay Gary Hart gimmick, was all about inviting, working with African-American wrestlers when others wouldn't. He had this real code. But he wasn't afraid to pull out, revert to that street smart kid and pull out the blade when needed. So tell us, you got to describe this blade to me. I'm just kind of, we'll start there. And, I know one of the more infamous uses of the blade came against the Missing Link. So if you want to get into some details on those, that'd be great.
Well, actually, Dad had cut a few guys, and Hawk and Steve Williams of the Road Warriors, every time Dad would get upset, they'd say, "Are you going to cut somebody?" They're like, "Boys!" And then Hawk says, "I think you're lying. I don't think you've ever cut anybody."
Oh.
And then Dad goes, "Hawk," and Hawk goes, "I want to see you do it." Steve Williams like, "Yeah, come on, cut somebody." Gary Dad was like, "Boys, for God's sake." They wanted to see him do it. The blade, because Dad was almost like, I'm not going to try to punch you and break my hand, Because he goes, "I'm not going to try to punch it out with anybody. This way, if you cut him, it's just the shock and the horror, and you gotta really, really want to. I mean, because it takes balls to cut somebody.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Throwing a punch. Yeah, you may just do the night in jail, but if you take a blade to somebody, you gotta be willing to, go to a place that they're not. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And that was just basically born of, fans a lot of times would be pretty violent. They would come at you. I mean, yeah, granted, wrestlers can beat up fans, but you're not, like Randy Savage said once, "I can't beat up all of them," not at once. That's where that came of. I mean, always have a weapon. I mean, like Dan was like, "I'm not that tough of a guy with my fist, so why am I going to try to punch you?" I'm either going to bite you, stick my finger in your eye, or slice you. And I'm guessing, and he actually, he had cut somebody that turned out to be, I think, a Royal Mounted Canadian policeman.
That made the hook, absolutely.
And he didn't exactly know at the time. So that way, when it was time for WCW to go work in Toronto, with Dad was telling Muda, "Boy, son, maybe we shouldn't go on this one." What's it? Get it, son? You cut. What? I hear you slash someone. But no, the most infamous was the missing link. Yeah, something happened. He had the link had come in here, and there's a story. I forget if this is in the book because it's been like about a year since I read the book. He had come back in here with Ken Mantell at the end of 87, beginning of 88.
Yeah.
And he had made a few off. He did some. Back then, it was a very, very tight-knit group. You didn't, try to pick up somebody's wife. You didn't make a lewd comment to somebody's wife. And you didn't pick on, like, an old man like Bronco Lubitsch. I mean, my dad and Uncle Donald would mess with Bronco, but they'd rib him in a loving way. You know what I'm
right.
saying? Like Dad would tell some of the guys, because Bronco hated to drop down to his knees to count, to make a long count, so Dad would tell some of the guys.
You couldn't tell.
Hey, yeah, and Dad would, because Kenji Muda told Dad years later, he goes, you know Bronco Lubitsch, right? And Dad goes, Daddy, son, sometimes he count with his foot. But Dad would tell one of his guys, he goes, hey, when he covers you and Bronco drops down, kick it one, you know? And then so a guy would do that twice, and then the guy would do it twice, and then Bronco would look at Dad like, damn you, Gary. You know, that kind of rib. But the link had been mean to Bronco, and he had made a few comments towards, I think it was Kerry Von Erich's wife. And Dad had gotten wind of it, and Dad was like, had pulled him off to the side at the sportatorium. And we used to have, like, remember where Bill Mercer used to sit to do the announcing?
Absolutely.
There was like a catwalk over the building, and that's where they would do the announcing. So one day, Dad had cornered the link up there after he'd heard all the stories about it. He saw him being mean to Bronco, and he'd said that to Kerry's wife. It was some lewd comment, and Dad said, if I ever hear of you picking on Bronco again or saying anything untoward to another wrestler's wife, you and me going to have a problem. And he said, what if I were to throw you off this ledge? And Dad said, well, I'll get up. And I told Dad, I said, because Dad told me stories years later, I said, you going to do anything then? Dad goes, no, because I had guys threaten me before. And like when you're a matchmaker, sometimes guys are upset with you. And then about two or three nights later, they were working at a high school gym in Garland, Texas, which is a suburb. It was right outside of Dallas. And the link came by, and he sort of like popped Dad upside down, kind of punched him, upside the shoulder. And wrestlers do that,
Sure.
I mean, they'll give each other chops and other stuff like that. I mean, they do that, because they're messing with each other. Dad's like, is he playing? Does he think everything's okay now? I'm not too sure. Because, I mean, because guys do that to each other sometimes.
Yeah, boys will be boys.
Yeah, exactly. And then he's lining out the card with Ed Watt, who was the pseudo matchmaker here that was actually a promoter, but that's the name they used in the program. So Ed would go dry for years without an idea, but then a flash of creativity would come. And so Dad was sitting there again, and here comes the link the next time. Boom! Knocks him right into the lockers. And Dad's like, okay, he ain't playing. He wants to fight. And so he starts whacking Dad, because the link is about 270 and juice full of roids. And he starts throwing a few haymakers. Dad's like, okay, this ain't going to go very long. I can't punch it out with it. So he goes into his cigarette case with the blade and then and just cuts him under the eye, cuts his chest a few times, and blood's going everywhere. A few seconds later, Dad hands the blade to Iceman Parsons. And Dad says, hold on to this for me, brother. I may need it again. Because Ice had told Dad a few days before, hey, Gary, Mantell and his crew have it in for you.
Yeah.
And Dad was like, oh, thanks, brother, because, I mean, coat of the street thing, because Dad and I always got along pretty well, both black guys. And Dad held the blade, and so Ice held the blade, and cops had run into the building in the dressing room right after the blade had come out. Dad's like, oh, you fell against the locker, man. And the cops are like, okay. And so Dad gets the blade back. So that tells you there may be a setup right there, what I'm saying?
Right.
Cops come in as soon as you slash a guy. Dad went got the blade back from Ice, and then he pulls Ken Mantell into the shower area, pulls the curtain, and lifts up the blade, and then Ken's screaming. He's like, Gary, I love you to death. You're my friend. I'd never do anything like this to you. And Dad goes, if I find out that you had anything to do with this, I'm going to cut you worse than I cut him. And Ken's like, Gary, I had nothing to do with it. Let's fast forward about 15 years later. Dad's at a convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. The link comes over.
Oh, wow.
And Dad's like, brother, I got nothing to say to you. What's done is done. He goes, no, Gary, I got to apologize to you. And Dad was like, for what? He goes, Ken Mantell had told me that if I got rid of you, that, I'd be a big star and you were the one that holding me back. And Dell was like, so Ken was lying that night,
as
usual. Yeah. So that's what happened with that. Yeah. And regrettably enough, Hawk and Steve Williams weren't there to watch Dad cut somebody. And I know that they were both jonesing. They wanted to see that.
And it was, he said we carried it in his, so this wasn't like a switchblade. It was something.
No, that's too obvious.
So it's just like a regular razor?
Yeah, regular razor blade. What would a wrestler know to do with that, right? No, yeah, it was like a regular. Yeah, it was a regular razor. And then he had, you've seen those X-Acto knives?
Yeah.
One of those, that came in later. See, like in the 80s, when the office supply stores helped cut the missing link, basically, because they had the X-Acto knife. Like, and then that's and I remember the next day, and I didn't know that this had happened, obviously. So I come downstairs the next morning, and Ed Watt, who happened to be there, who was sitting on the bench with Dad when that happened, he called the house, and I picked the phone and goes, hello? He goes, Jason? I said, yeah. He goes, is your dad home? I said, I said, yeah, he's home, but I think he's still asleep. And he goes, is your dad all right? And I was like, yeah, he's fine. I mean, yeah, you're not going to call him. Hey, well, what happened? Yeah, well, I cut the link last night, you know?
Right.
And then so I gave Dad, and Dad came down the stairs and said, Dad, Ed Watt's on the phone for you. I put down the phone with Ed Watt, and Dad sits down, and I think Ed says, are you okay? And Dad says, Dad goes, brother, I'm from Chicago. Stuff like that don't bother me. And I have no idea what they're talking about. So I don't find out until a couple hours later. And then Dad, and then Al Perez said, he goes, yeah, Gary, I went up to the link. I'm going to say, cut yourself shaving? Yeah, so yeah, that's, yeah. But I mean, but like I told my brother, I said, you know, it's lucky it was just the blade because it, Brody, or Uncle Dahl or Perez been in the dressing room, or Kevin Von Erich when that happened, the link would have died that night. He got off easy. He only got cut. They'd have killed him.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that thing has seemed to have grown in folklore, yeah. I think Michael Hayes was there when it happened, too.
Well, the book is Playboy Gary Hart, My Life in Wrestling, with a little help from my friends. Again, it's available at playboygaryhart.net. And my highest recommendation, we've just kind of scratched the surface of this book. I mean, we're talking Gary Hart, and we haven't even talked about Abdullah the Butcher. You've mentioned Bruiser Brody, but, I mean, there's plenty of details about them. Tons on the spoiler. Much, much more than we could ever get into regarding world-class championship wrestling.
And also the most talented man ever in the history of wrestling, my Uncle Marky Mark Lewin. Yeah,
there you go.
The true Renaissance man.
I mean, it's a fascinating book. It's a great history lesson for those of you who want to know more about the territory days. I really learned a lot from reading this book. Just a fascinating read. Again, my highest recommendation. Check it out. Available at playboygaryhart.net. Is this just a limited release again? Because I know the first time around was.
I believe this is the third printing of it, and I believe it's going to be a limited release again. I know what they tell me. I'm like a WWE employee. I just go along with what they tell me.
Well, it's an absolute classic, and again,
I appreciate it. I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, I really did. It's the best wrestling book that I think most fans have yet to read, and it's a real treasure, so check it out. Jason, thank you very much for the time. I really enjoyed kind of a stroll through a book that really stuck with me, and it was a lot of fun, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, and I hope that Donovan McNabb thing works out.
Yeah, well, hopefully it's a year and we switch to Ponder, but that's another story for another day. But thanks again. I really appreciate it, everybody. One more time, the website to get the book, playboygaryhart.net.